The Athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your go-to Newcastle United podcast brought to you by The Athletic. First up, thanks for all your positive feedback after our discussion with Jose Enrique last week. It was an absolute pleasure to speak to him. What a great lad. And if you thought that was a treat, you're in for an absolute belter this week. This one's going to be something special. We're celebrating the birthday of the King. Happy Valentine's Day. It's Kevin Keegan's birthday special. And who better to talk about one Newcastle legend than another Newcastle legend? We have got Mr. Alan Shearer joining us for a chat. That's going to be amazing. You might want to brace yourselves though as well, because we're going to be going back to a pivotal match in the notorious 95-96 title race. And of course, there's the return of the quiz. And this week, it's a Kevin Keegan special. And George has cooked up some absolute stinker questions for us, and I'm sure he's ready to get his own back on me and Chris. But before all of that, let's speak to the lads, Chris and George. Chris, how are you doing? Are you well?
Well, I'm trying not to think about last night's game too much. I cheered myself up by making pancakes this morning, because it is obviously Pancake Tuesday.
Oh, sure. Tuesday, isn't it?
Delicious. So, yeah.
I forgot about that.
So I'll just forget about the football.
How are you doing, George? Are you good?
Yes, I'm very, very much walking in a Keegan wonderland. I'm not prepared to allow the current incarnation of Newcastle to spoil anything. And Keegan, Shearer, what could be better?
I mean, it's the perfect combination, isn't it?
It's just incredible. And, you know, Keegan was Shearer's hero as a kid, and they got to work together, and now Shearer's interviewed Keegan. It was just great. Yeah, it reminds you of Newcastle's power, and obviously it's in the past now, but it also reminds you of Newcastle's potential when they're all rowing in the same direction, as Kevin put it in that interview.
Absolutely. And that piece, the Alan Shearer interview with Kevin Keegan, is available at the minute on The Athletic. Chris, have you got anything coming up this week?
Well, just to briefly touch upon the unfortunate modern day, I have done a piece on the Chelsea game.
Must we?
Well, unfortunately. And the Chelsea game, and basically it's almost looking at the fact that in some ways, if you were to step away and think of it not as a fan and look at it rationally, Newcastle are still 7 points ahead of Fulham, albeit Fulham got two games to play before Newcastle next play. They've actually won two of their last four games. The form is better, but yet it feels so much worse. And Monday felt really bad, and there seems to be this sense of trepidation. So there's a piece about that. And then also a very special Freddie Woodman interview coming out later in the week. I spoke to him about his time down at Swansea. He's doing really well there. They're in the promotion hunt, and he speaks about Newcastle. So yeah, that interview is coming out later in the week.
Brilliant. Well, before we get into all of that, let me just tell you, the Champions League returns this week. I don't know why you'd need to know that as a Newcastle fan, but it does. And there's no better time to sign up for our unrivaled coverage at The Athletic. Until February 25th, we're offering new subscribers a half-price annual subscription. That's less than £1 a week for an entire year. To redeem that limited time offer, go to theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. That's theathletic.com/NewcastlePod. And you can keep up with all of the wonderful Newcastle United Champions League news.
I think if it was Championship, you might get a few Newcastle fans signing up for that.
Yeah, we could get away with that.
You sign up, you know, use that promo, that's fine. But read about Kevin Keegan and Alan Shearer, come on.
Fantastic. Well, listen, lads, let's not beat around the bush anymore. We've got a fantastic, exciting episode to get on with. We're going to talk to Alan Shearer now. Come on, let's get on with this.
Shearer!
Well, ladies and gentlemen, please be upstanding, put your hands together out there in audio land, and welcome a very, very special guest today. We have got none other than Newcastle legend, Mr. Alan Shearer, joining us. Hello, Alan, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How's everyone?
Yeah, we're not bad. George and Chris are here as well, and it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
I can see their ugly mugs. They look fine, yeah.
Well, I mean, before we get into this, we've got lots to talk about today. We're going to talk about your foundation and also about Kevin Keegan as well. But just before we start, what was all that about last night, the Chelsea game? It wasn't great, was it?
No, I think that's being polite. It was. I was working on it for the Premier League. So it was, it was poor. First off, showed nothing. Didn't ask anything of Chelsea defensively. Second off, the intensity improved slightly, but still, I thought Chelsea were in cruise control. It was a bit like a practice match for them. I thought they never were under any serious threat, and probably a little bit of combination of Newcastle stepping it up a little bit and Chelsea thinking the game was won in the second half, and they just saw the game out. And I thought it was poor.
Yeah, Steve Bruce said the second half was an improvement, but it was very flat, wasn't it? There wasn't really anything there. It turned into a bit of a dull affair in that second half.
No, it couldn't be any worse in the first half, because it was I thought it was dreadful in the first half. But there was a slight improvement, only slight. I mean, they got higher up the pitch. There was more intensity in their play, but only slightly. I never ever once felt that they could or were going to get back into the game. And Callum Wilson's pace and experience and know-how was sadly missed last night.
It's a strange situation where in the past few weeks, Newcastle have probably played their best football of the season, but they're in 17th place and the league table does not look good. And obviously Fulham winning their last match, that's a source of concern. Are we worried yet? Should we be worried? Are you worried? Are you concerned about the league position?
Slightly concerned. I mean, Fulham had a great result at Everton, played really well. They might have found a goal scorer, because that's the one thing that I think that Fulham have been missing, because when you look at their games, a lot of them have been drawn, and you just think with someone who can put the ball on the back of the net, someone who can sniff a chance out from 6, 7, 8 yards, then they could be a different team. So from their point of view, very good. But from a Newcastle point of view, no, that's not good, particularly when we have injuries ourselves and losing our best player and our important striker who can put the ball on the back of the net. So, yeah, slightly concerned. Do I think that we will go down? No, I don't. But I'm not sitting comfortable, no.
You mentioned Wilson being out, Alan. I mean, last night, Gayle, I don't know whether it was he hasn't played a lot of football, whether the role was slightly different, didn't suit him, but he didn't look particularly comfortable for most of last night. What do you think is the answer? Because obviously Newcastle don't have a leg-for-leg replacement for Callum Wilson. How do you think they can try and compensate for what is going to be 2 months without the best player?
Yeah, well, if you look at the system change that Newcastle have had over the past few games, it's playing with two split strikers and obviously Almiron in behind. And at times, even Callum Wilson finds himself on the right-hand side and having to track back a bit when he was playing. But certainly that last night didn't suit Dwight Gayle. I mean, Dwight Gayle is a striker who wants to get in and around the 6-yard box. It would probably be slightly harsh to judge him on last night's performance, because it'll be slightly easier and slightly better for him and the team, I think, if they were to play at home against a lesser team, perhaps against Wolves would be a better barometer to judge him on. But no, that role last night didn't suit him, and Newcastle just didn't look comfortable in it, because they never really got started, never really got going. You never seen the intent. You never seen Newcastle go after Chelsea like you have in the past two or three games.
Alan, just before we go any further, I just want to check, is George's Zoom background really upsetting you or putting you off in any way? Because I'll be honest, it's freaking me out a little bit.
That's my last ever kick of a football, that picture behind George. In my professional career, yeah, that's my goal at Sunderland, my penalty. And that will taste very nice indeed. I never kicked another football after that.
Oh, wow. Well, thanks.
Great picture, George. Don't let them bully you.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Alan, I want to move on a little bit now. I want to talk to you a little bit about the foundation, about the Alan Shearer Foundation, about the fantastic work you're doing. And also, you've got an amazing competition raffle going on at the minute as well. What's new with the foundation? What's happening at the moment?
Well, like all charities, nothing is the answer. Nothing's going on at all. We're still busy funding the people that live in there. Unfortunately, the centre side of it is shut down, the activity centre, because people can't go. And the only people that can use it are the residents in there, unfortunately. But, we've not been able to raise any funds for the last 12 months because of obvious reasons, exactly the same as every other charity, I suppose. So I thought, well, how can I help? And I thought the easiest and quickest and best way to help would be to try and give a decent prize away. So I looked around them. As you may know, I've got plenty of tops and boots and what have you from over the years that mean a lot to me. And there are some very special ones. I just thought that giving one of those away, it would help try and raise a much needed funds and that we could give to the foundation, because for that activity centre to be given away for free, that costs us around 250 grand a year. So we need the funds. And I asked my kids if they would mind I give that top away, my 250th Premier League goal and the boots and the armband that I scored against Man City back in February 2005. And they very kindly agreed. So we put it up for a prize draw. I mean, the decision then was, I mean, what can we put it up for? Is it £5, £10, £20? I mean, so we decided on £10. I understand it's a lot of money, but goodness me, the response has just been phenomenal. I mean, the last time I looked, I think it was £109,000, and we've got another 6 days to go, I think, which has just been, I mean, the response has been phenomenal. Whoever wins it, I've got nothing to do with the draw, because I know plenty of my friends have bought tickets as well. So I've said I want nothing to do with it. So someone will do the draw, and then I'll either present the top and the boots to someone at my centre if they can make it up there when we're allowed to, or I can get it posted to them and I'll do a Zoom call with them and thank everyone for their support.
Yeah, so firstly, you should tell us how people can enter that draw.
Yeah, they can enter, George, thanks, by going on to my social media channels, Twitter and Instagram at Alan Shearer. And there's a link there that will take you to it. You'll be able to see how much we've raised so far. You'll also be able to see the great work the Alan Shearer Foundation does. I mean, you know as well as I do that I had my testimonial in 2006, and we raised around about £1.6 million from that game. I mean, the easy part was giving the money away. I was never, ever going to keep that money. But the hard part was deciding who I could give it to, because there is no such thing as a bad charity. And we sort of set the vast majority or most of it was given to set up this centre and my foundation. And I was determined not just to hand the money over and just walk away from it. I wanted to give the money to them and then to take an active part in it. And it was an old derelict building that needed kitting out. And we got to work, or everyone got to work. And we've now got this amazing centre with sensory rooms, with bedrooms, with hydrotherapy pool, with cinema room, with music rooms, which is unbelievable. And it's there for people with complex disabilities. It's an amazing place. You've been there yourself, George, and it means so much to me and the family. And we love going up there and seeing the energy and the happiness that it gives so many people.
You mentioned that I've been there. I came up last year and interviewed you there, and wanted to write about that and write about sort of you as a person. And I was blown away by it. As you say, it sort of, I think the thing that I was sort of most taken with was that it is this kind of very grand, austere building, but then inside it's a kind of riot of colour and happiness and kids smiling. And everybody who was there was sort of saying that it offers something that isn't available anywhere else. Mm. And so it's it must be really tough for those people who now can't use it.
Yeah, I mean, I've had several messages, George, on Twitter telling me how much the people are missing it and how much they sort of look forward to going and how much it is a release for them. Because it is a respite centre. If you have got a child with a disability, you can sort of take them there for an hour, for 2 hours, all day, a weekend, and it just gives their parents a little bit of a break, and it also gives them a chance to, I suppose, see that put some smiles on people's faces. And of course, that's what's needed at this difficult time, and they can't get up there. But I mean, it's not just me. I mean, it couldn't operate without the kindness of so many people, because as I said, we need £250,000 a year to help give that away for free and to run the centre. So what we do to raise funds for that is that we have a ball and we have a golf day every year, and for the last 7 years we've had an unbelievable black tie ball at the Hilton Hotel in Gateshead there, where I mean, for free as well. These guys have come and done it for free just to support me and to support the foundation. We've had the likes of Ed Sheeran and Lewis Capaldi and Marcus Mumford, Mumford and Sons, Jess Glynn, Ollie Mears, Gary Barlow, Ronan Keating, Michael McIntyre. All these guys have come and performed for us for nothing. And that's where we get the vast majority of our funds. But of course, we've not been able to do that the last 12 months. And hence we are here with me, giving my top and my boots away. And it'll go a long way to help and fund it for the next 12 months.
I think when you list out those names, it's very, very sort of, you know, they're very famous people, and it's your ball is a amazing sort of night. But again, I think the thing about the foundation is just sort of how democratic it is and how it's sort of open to everybody. The people who go there, they don't pay anything. And I think the other thing that, you know, without sort of embarrassing you, well, I'll embarrass you a little bit, so I don't really care, was that sort of was how when you walked through the door, everybody knew who you were. I mean, so in other words, it doesn't matter if you never, ever went to visit it, but you raise money for it. But you walk through the door and you were immediately recognised by everybody, and you go there sort of every 3 or 4 weeks when it's open, and it's become a sort of huge passion for you. And I think you said at the time, it's one of the things that helped fill the void for you post playing, having this incredible facility for people. But it's not something that you just give money to and then leave it to run itself. You're very much part of the fabric of it, aren't you?
When I walk through the door, I'm just Shearer. They don't really give a damn what I've done. They might not even know that I've played football, which is a relief for me that I can just walk in there and be who I am and be normal and go around and see everyone. And yeah, everyone knows my name, but the kids might not know what I did. The kids might not know that I used to score goals for a living for Newcastle. So, but I think that's great for me as well, that I can go up there and I can have a bit of a release and enjoy myself. But what the enjoyment gives me is just seeing everyone else being so happy in there. And it's my way of trying to give something back, because, I mean, Jesus, I mean, I was such a lucky lad to play football. I would have played football even if I hadn't been paid for it. I just so happened to be half decent at it, and I got a few quid for playing it. So that's my way of trying to give something back. Can you imagine the pride and the pleasure that I get by driving on the A69 when I see a sign saying the Alan Shearer Centre, and then I can go in there and see this huge building with all the facilities that I've mentioned and seeing all these people using it? It's amazing for me. I love it.
It's incredible. And it's clear that you're very emotionally and personally invested in this. And it's not just a thing to stick the Alan Shearer name on it. It's very much it's an amazing place. And like you say, I always get that when I drive past that sign on the A69 and see it, and I think, oh, the Alan Shearer Foundation, that's fantastic. It must make you feel amazing.
Yeah, it does. I'm very, very proud of it. As I said, it's a great place. All the staff that run it are all dedicated and look forward to going there and enjoy. I think that's important also. You've got to enjoy going into their job. They really do enjoy it. And I can see that on all their faces, which is hugely important to me.
Fantastic stuff. Well, we're going to move on a little bit now, and we're going to talk about the main man himself. It's been his birthday on Valentine's Day, Mr. Kevin Keegan. I want to spend a little bit of time talking to you about him. And I've read the interview that you did with him recently, and it was a wonderful, wonderful read. And it got a fantastic response on social media over the weekend. And a lot of Newcastle fans were actually quite emotional reading that. What was it like for you speaking to Kevin after all this time?
Do you know what? That's so spooky. I just looked at my phone and my phone's gone and I can see it come up. It's Keegan Mobile. He's just tried to ring me because he's just had a nice bottle of wine delivered to say thank you.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he was my hero. I went to watch Kevin as an 11-year-old when he made his debut in 1982. Wasn't it against QPR as a player? And I was like all the other thousands of kids who used to follow him around. I was a Pied Piper. So to watch him, then I wanted to be in his boots. I wanted to be that iconic figure that once ran on to St. James's Park and was adored by the fans. I wanted that feeling. I wanted what he had. And that sort of helped
drive me to try and be a professional footballer. Everyone's got heroes, everyone's got idols. He was mine. I was lucky enough to go to one of his old Blue Star soccer days that they did, the brewery did back then. And that was it. I loved Newcastle. I stood on the Gallagher as a kid. So to go and watch him and then to watch him do what he did as a manager and then for him to eventually buy me, or not him personally, but then the club that he was managing, Newcastle Art Club, to then pay that world record fee for me was it was brilliant. I've kept in touch with him anyway. I often bump into him now and again. The thing that everyone will say about Kevin Keegan, whether you speak to him now or whether you speak to him 20, 30, 40 years ago, the thing that everyone will say is how passionate he is, how enthusiastic he is, how much time he'll give people. I mean, that's never changed. That was when I went to see him when I was a 12 and 13-year-old. He sat down and signed as many autographs as he wanted. I mean, he must have been fed up with me as a kid because I used to go to the training ground. I used to go to the ground. I was one of these kids that I used to hang around. I used to stand outside my school gates and wait for him to drive past Gosforth High Street in his Jaguar. So he must have thought I was a stalker or a pest or something. But that's what I thought of him.
Fantastic.
And he just has so much passion for football. And the biggest thing is he gets it. He gets what fans want. He gets what people want. And that's what he gave to Newcastle.
I was very, very lucky. I'm a very, very lucky lad because I got to listen to Alan's conversation with Kevin last week. And, you know, I think I said it was the most enjoyable 90 minutes I've had for a very, very long time, hearing two of the sort of biggest icons in Newcastle's history chatting away with each other. I would have been happy if that had lasted forever. I mean, I was a fan when Keegan was manager the first time and went down to Maiden Castle and was one of those thousands of people outside the training ground. I mean, I think the thing to remember is it's that great reminder of how powerful a successful Newcastle can be and how good that team was. And I know you only worked with him for a short period of time, Alan, but that was Newcastle absolutely at its peak, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when I was with Blackburn, I used to go away with England. And a couple of the Newcastle lads were there, Rob Lee and what have you. And they used to tell me about the training sessions, how many thousands of fans used to go to their training sessions. And I showed you it, George, didn't I, the other day about that.
Yeah.
I dug a picture out of thousands of people at Durham at the training ground. I mean, there were 10, 15 deep halfway around the pitch. And I just thought, I don't know. But then I signed for Newcastle and then became part of that. And I just thought, my God, it was like, you obviously couldn't do it now for security reasons, but that was just Kevin. That was him wanting to engage with the fans, wanting the fans to be part of the club. And it was an unreal experience, I promise. I mean, driving into training every day and seeing thousands of people, I used to think to myself, well, why aren't all these people and kids at school or at work? And they used to come and watch us. And Kevin's training sessions were always fun. We're always five or six asides. And I mean, it must have been brilliant for the fans to come in to be part of that.
It was, yeah. I used to go down in school holidays occasionally with
I recognise your face and stuff. A pest like I was to Keegan, weren't you, with all the autographs all the time?
Absolutely, yeah. Never stopped.
Alan, I just wanted to ask you about coming back to Newcastle. Obviously, it was your club and you said you stood on the Gallagher and there was that emotional connection. But what role did Kevin Keegan really have in that? How influential was he in helping you make that decision? Because obviously Manchester United were interested in you as well. He was the world record transfer fee. You were one of the best strikers in the world at the time. How influential was Kevin?
No, he was the best striker in the world.
My apologies, yes.
Well said, George. Yeah, I mean, I didn't sign for Kevin Keegan. I signed for Newcastle. And I think that's always important when someone is making that decision. But yeah, he was, I mean, I go back to all the things about him being passionate, him being enthusiastic. It was blatantly obvious how much he loved Newcastle, how much he wanted to be a success and go on and win things. And all of that came across in the meeting. I saw both him and Sir Alex on the same day in the same house. The Newcastle contingent came in the morning. Could see them coming all in their blacked out cars and pulling into the drive. And it was like a presidential thing. It was unbelievable. Douglas and Freddie and the guys from the brewery and Kevin, what have you. We were in actually in David Platt's mother-in-law's house in Cheshire.
Wow.
And then talks had gone great. And then I saw Alex in the afternoon. And I sort of went, I went home and I said to the missus, I said, I think I'm going to go to Man United. I think I've made my mind up. I'm not certain yet, but I'm going to give it a few days. And then I got a call a couple of days later off Kevin. Said, can I have another meeting with you? Can I have another another half an hour with you? He said the team are due to fly out to the Far East on a pre-season trip, but I'd like another half an hour with you. So I said, yeah, of course. And I still hadn't made my mind up. I was back to being 50-50 then, whether it was Newcastle or Man United. And I just sat down with Kevin again, and all the memories of me and the Gallagher and sort of came flooding back. And I believe it or not, of all places, I went to meet him in Manchester, just near Manchester Airport, because he was going to fly straight out to the Far East. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to sign for Newcastle. My mind's made up. That's it. I'm going home. I can't let this opportunity go. It's always been my dream to go back home. And that was it. I rang the missus up and I said, I'm at Manchester Airport. I'm going to sign for Newcastle. Can you pack me a bag? You're going to have to send it in a taxi because I lived in Formby, which is near Liverpool. I said, I need a bag. I'm going to be away for about 10 days. You're going to have to either you bring it or put it in the taxi. And she did. She packed me a bag. She put it in a taxi. It was delivered to Manchester Airport. And that was it. I never, ever went back home. I never went back to that house. I went out to the Far East on pre-season and that was it. So that was the decision made.
Incredible. It must have been an amazing feeling coming back. And everyone's seen those images of you outside of St James's Park with all the fans there and stuff. And again, it was like a Tuesday afternoon or something and all the kids were there and there was nobody at school in the surrounding areas. It's just an incredible scene. And watching the video now, it looks amazing.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I should have known what was going to happen, really, but I just couldn't believe the reaction. I mean, I don't know how many was there, 15 or 16,000. It was a dreadful day in terms of the weather. It was pouring rain. And we'd done all we had to do inside the ground, the formalities, and et cetera. And then the unveiling, it was at the back of the Leasers End on the corner, wasn't it? We're just looking over the car park. There'd been a stand built and what have you. But then I walked out into this sea of black and white cheering fans. And again, I thought, oh, gee, this. I don't know whether it was a school day or not. I can't remember. But, I mean, there was the response and it was just amazing. Then I knew then I'd done the right thing.
And it was an astonishing spell that. I mean, it was the end of it really for you, but Kevin had been responsible along with Sir John and the others really just completely and utterly reshaping the team and the club, playing that extraordinary football. And, you know, you say very eloquently in the interview that without him, you know, the modern Newcastle just wouldn't exist. And you know, for all that there's been a very sort of, you know, bitter sort of fallout between him and the current regime, his place in history should be marked at Newcastle, shouldn't it? I mean, I know he wouldn't accept it. He made that point himself. But we should be able to sort of celebrate his contribution to Newcastle in the same way that we can see your contribution there with your statue, the way we can see Sir Bobby recognise Jackie Milburn as well. He should have some sort of permanent memorial. Sounds like he passed away, but you know what I mean?
Without doubt, he should have a stand named after him or a statue or something that recognises what he did for that football club. Because you're right, I mean, Sir Bobby wouldn't have been there. Sir Bobby wouldn't have had his statue. I wouldn't have been there. I wouldn't have had my statue. The ground wouldn't have been there. The ground was an old, decrepit, fallen to pieces ground. I mean, he came in and he saved the club. He revolutionised the club, changed it from top to bottom. So yeah, there's no doubt about it that. And I would think that any if or when Newcastle is ever taken over, then I would think it would be the simplest thing to do for new owners is to come in. And it would be a great piece of PR for whoever that is going to be, whether it's in a month's time or 10 years' time or whenever it may be, that they would recognise what Kevin Keegan did for Newcastle United.
Do I want to go back and be sat next to Derek Lambias or Mike Ashley. You know, I wouldn't want to go back there. You know, someone said to me Saturday afternoon, where would you like to go, Liverpool or Newcastle? Sadly, not sadly, because I love Liverpool too, but it'd be Liverpool every time because everybody's treated properly there, you know, not ridiculously over the top, but you're made welcome. I don't miss Newcastle because if I went to Newcastle, I'd want to go back and enjoy it. The best day of the lab is when he sells the club because anybody, and I mean anybody, can run it better. It cannot be run worse than it is. I've had people emailing me saying they're very interested and I don't know the people. So I've had a couple of those, if you like, phishing emails. But the people who do it properly, they'll do it in a way which is very open and they'll buy the club first, I guess, and then they'll look at what they need to do to get it back somewhere where it was, you know.
It's PR, but it's also about being allowed to reclaim that history, isn't it? I mean, for all of us, whether you're fans, whether it's former players like yourself, you know, former player and manager, but, you know, it's so difficult to feel that sense of love around at the club at the moment, to feel like you belong to part, you know, to something. So being able to celebrate our heroes is, you know, it's what football's about, isn't it? It's not just what's happening on the pitch now, it's about the past.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been lucky, George, over the past few months. We've been able to interview some iconic figures in the world of football. I mean, whether that's Ronald Koeman. I mean, Ronald Koeman is manager of the biggest football club in the world and now in Barcelona. Steven Gerrard was an unbelievable player, now doing great things at Rangers. Frank Lampard in England, great. Obviously, hasn't worked out with Chelsea and all these guys. But the reaction to Kevin Keegan, I mean, that piece that we did at the weekend, the reaction to that was unbelievable. I mean, that tells you the feeling that people have for him here in Newcastle and appreciate what he did for their football club. And you know why? They know why they've got that feeling? Because he gave them their football club back. And whenever he addresses Newcastle United, it's always the people. It's always there. It's always them. It's not nothing ever to do about him, although it should be as far as we're concerned. But that's why the people engage so well with him, because he gives them their football club.
He's still massively loved up here, isn't he? And I think that's always going to be the case. And like you say, a stand or a statue or something would be a really fitting tribute to him. With the way things are at the minute with Newcastle, he said in the interview it was difficult to come back and he didn't feel comfortable coming back. And obviously, I know you've had your disagreements and stuff over the years with the regime, and it's been, you still come back to the ground to watch games when you can. It must be hard for him to deal with that, because Newcastle's in his blood, isn't it? But he said in the interview he'd be more comfortable going to Liverpool than he would coming to Newcastle. And I completely understand that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he's only been back twice. He told us that once was he was in disguise, and once was for the unveiling of my statue outside of the
Kevin Keegan.
It is, yeah, outside of the football club. As you know, I'm friendly with the manager, and he would have no problem inviting me into the training ground or to the ground, and I've been in. But I don't feel welcome. I just go in. I do what I have to do. I work. I go into a friend's box when we could. And I leave again. So I just go and watch the football if or when I can. I mean, it's not very often that I could go in there, even if we could be in there. So, yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult for him. But, it shouldn't be after what he achieved for our football club. I don't see the point in any of it.
Yeah. Do you know what? I hate that he felt it when he said, you know, there's that two parts of you. On the one part, of course, I want Newcastle to do well. On the other side of it, you know, there's part of me that doesn't want Newcastle to do well because he feels so sort of sad or upset about the way the club's run. And, you know, I'm sure that will kind of resonate with a lot of Newcastle fans. But, I mean, I look forward to the day when Newcastle feels like a kind of proper football club again and he's allowed to come back, and the noise that will be made with people singing his name again. It's a lovely thing. He tapped into the club and the club's potential in a way that we just haven't seen before. And I doubt we'll see again somebody who just got it, who understood and just saw the club for how big it can be.
It's not a unique situation. I mean, Kevin told us a story about what happened to him when he walked out 6 months or whatever it was after I signed. Yeah, it's a difficult situation for so many. Unfortunately, we can't do anything about it. We can keep on doing what we have to do. But, yeah, it's a tough one. Really, really difficult. I know the pain that he's going through.
I feel sad for the punters because I know what they're like, you know. I know them. You know, what helped me a lot when I went to play for Newcastle in 82-84 was the breweries paid most of my contract. I mean, Newcastle didn't. So I had to do nights, usually about one a week. I was going in the working men's clubs and the big pubs, you know, and we'd have these, like, talkings. Mm. And where you learn about your club, you know, the passion for the club. If you're just a footballer who goes and then you go to your house at night and then you go and play on a Saturday and then you go back to your house, you don't get that. When you go into the clubs, you know, and people are coming up to you and you see the passion, it has a massive effect on you. So I'm not saying players should do that now, but I think players don't understand that now. They're almost shielded from it. The buses go under the stadium. The players don't come out and sign autographs, you know. They get cars to pick them up at the back and they're off, you know. We definitely invested a lot of time in getting to know, or I did, because of my deal. It was forced on me, really, so I'm not being clever when I say that. But it kept me, wow, you know. Because I never had that at Liverpool or Hamburg. You know, I never went and really had a massive mix with the supporters. But in Newcastle, I did. So you get to know what they're like. And you know what they want. They don't mind you losing 3-2 if it's a great game. But they don't want to see a 0-0. It's a strange thing to say. And that's probably why we didn't win the league.
Can you just tell us, Alan, what it was like actually playing for Kevin and actually being in that team? Obviously, the brilliant players that there were, the likes of David Ginola, you and Les Ferdinand up front. Did it click straight away? Was it different to what you'd experienced before? What was it that he said to you before he went out on the pitch?
Go and win. honestly, it was he had that much sort of belief in... I'd come from Blackburn with Kenny. And Kenny was director of football with Blackburn the year I left because we'd won the league the year before and it had gone upstairs. But it was the same principle with Ray Harford. We were well organised, albeit they never ever stopped us trying things and going out and letting us express our ability. But then coming to Newcastle was slightly different. I mean, there was myself, Les, Peter, Tino, Ginola, Keith Gillespie. I mean, it just didn't seem right. It couldn't function, all of those players. But Kevin was determined to try and get as many of us in the team as possible, and he did most of the time. My first game was Man United in a charity shield, and we got smacked 4-0 at Wembley, I was thinking, oh my God. But then the first league game, if I remember correctly, we went to Goodison against Everton, and we got done 2-0. And I thought, my God, what have I done here? What a rick I've made here coming to this club. But it got better after that. I scored in my home debut against Wimbledon, and then things started to improve then. But yeah, it was literally just go and show us what you've got, lads. Go and play. And if you want to do that, you can go and do that. Go and try things. Go and entertain, because that's what he was. That's what he wanted us to do. And it was at times, I mean, because of where I'd come from, I'd had two unbelievable wingers in Wilcox and Ripley at Blackburn, which the system at Blackburn was just designed for me and Chris Sutton to go and score goals. And then I've come to Newcastle and I've got Tino who's doing tricks and flicks and this, that. I've got Ginola on the left side, unbelievable ability, going past someone thinking, all right, well, I'll stop and I'll beat him again. And I'm making all these runs and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, is there any chance of getting some balls into the box? And then after five or six games, myself and David had words in the dressing room, and then things were all right after that.
That's a euphemism if ever I've heard one. Words.
Yeah, there were different words. We didn't quite come to blows, but we had interesting words. It wasn't far away. But then after that, things were great. Balls were flying into the box, left, right, and centre. And myself and Les, again, it was dreamland with having those two on the wing, whipping all those balls.
I love that story that Kevin told about, you know, he was like talking just generally about the team, but he sort of said, you know, we even had fullbacks who wanted to get, so it's like you've got Ginola on one side, yeah. Beresford gives him the ball, and then the first thing Beresford does is go past, and he told that story about standing on the touchline. I said, you know, Bez, just hang back, let him go, and then Bez turning around and telling him to fuck off.
Then he dragged him off, didn't he? Got him pulled, dragged him off and turned him for swearing at him. Yeah.
If you were a central defender at the time in the Premier League and you look up and you see Alan Shearer and Les Ferdinand standing on the halfway line ready to kick off, you'd shit yourself, wouldn't you? You would absolutely shit yourself.
That was the good thing. I mean, even when Les left, we got Big Duncan after that as well. And of course, with me and Les, or me and Dunk, stood in the tunnel. Honestly, I think half of our battles were won before we actually went onto the pitch, because we both could look after ourselves. We both liked the physical battle. We were both decent in the air. Les was quicker than I was. We could both score goals. So much for two big men not working together in a partnership.
Yes, exactly. Well, listen, Alan, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. The Keegan piece was brilliant, and good luck with everything with the foundation this year as well. And let's see how high we can get that raffle to go away. It's an amazing cause.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
Shearer hits it. Oh, what a goal! Shearer takes Newcastle to Wembley.
Oh, well, lads, I don't know about you, but I feel like I need a bit of a lie down after that. What an incredible half an hour of chat with a legend about a legend. It was just it was a wonderful interview with Shearer.
Legend squared. The legend. Legend cubed.
Outstanding stuff. We're going to go back now. We're going to go back in the annals of time, as we do often on the podcast, and we're going to think about a game which was a pivotal moment in the 95-96 title challenge, a game which Keegan talks about and Shearer talk about in that interview as well, and we're going to have a little look at that now. But first, just have a little listen to this.
The great sporting arena of St James's Park plays host to a game that is certainly going to shape the destiny of the 1995-96 Premiership title.
Man United at home was the turning point, because we absolutely battered them.
Ferdinand has made the run. Les Ferdinand! Good save again by Schmeichel. Second time in the opening 5 minutes that Schmeichel has denied Ferdinand.
Schmeichel was unbelievable.
But they can't cope with Ferdinand and Faustino Asprilla.
We beat them 5. Yeah, that's
right.
It went better the year we lost
1-0. Drive! Oh, it's off the woodwork! And Ferdinand almost got a second bite.
Do you think so, yeah? Have a look back at Schmeichel's performance in that game. The chances that we have.
Good drive!
The block shots.
Beats early for a second time. Ferdinand inches away.
Ball waiting in the box. This is Giggs, who's let it run for Cole. Run along the whole line. Phil Neville's cross. Cantona coming in, and he scored for Manchester United.
If we'd have won 2-3-0 when you played, and we beat them 5, it probably would have been about right. And if we'd have beat them 5-0 when we lost 1-0, it would have been spot on, you know.
Touchdown from Ferdinand, possibility for Lee, and again it's the frame of Peter Schmeichel that makes sure there's no sight of goal.
They're the little things that you can't change, but you know, it wasn't meant to be.
The final whistle has gone. Eric Cantona's goal may well prove crucial when the history of the 1995-96 season is
read. You just look at it now, as a Newcastle point of view, and you think, when will they ever get another chance?
Wiping away a single saline tear trickling down my cheek. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Cheers, man. Oh, dear. Wow.
It does not stir some memories up listening to that, doesn't it? I mean, along with Keegan's input there as well. God almighty, how close we came. How close we came. And that game itself was just... It was the turning point, wasn't it?
It was a phenomenal game. I mean, I'm still staggered to hear him say that it could have been 5-0, but I was there. I was in the stand. I was in what was my season ticket at the time in the Gallagher end watching it, and it was just absolutely extraordinary. It was just wave after wave after wave after wave of Newcastle attack, and it was like, no, we're going to win, we're going to win. Yeah. And then I sort of have that dim memory of that, of at some point in that game, that it's like, it's we're not going to win. It's like, this is going to be one of those games. And Schmeichel was astonishing. I think that is the best goalkeeping performance in terms of like a whole game that I've ever seen. And yeah, leaving with that just sense of emptiness because Cantona got that goal. And I mean, you have to remember though, I mean, it's a very Newcastle story, this, for us, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But Manchester United were astonishing in the second half of that season.
They were relentless, weren't they?
They were absolutely relentless. I've got their fixtures in front of me now. And from the 16th of January on, it was just win, 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 win.
Lots of them 1-0, Cantona, 70th towards minute the end,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
In the last few games. And Peter Schmeichel, man of the match, more often than not as well. But I remember that game vividly because I wasn't there, actually. I was only, I would only been 14 at the time. I wasn't at the game. I was listening to that in my bedroom in the little council house in Jarrow. And when Cantona scored that goal, I kicked the bed next to me very hard and really hurt my foot. And I must have effed and jeffed for about 20 minutes to the point where my mum came upstairs and was like, are you okay? What's going on? And I was like, you know, and a typical teenage overreaction. But I still feel it now. I still feel that emotion. It was just, it was heartbreak, wasn't it, Chris?
Well, it's slightly different for me because I was actually 4 years old at the time. So I don't. So just to make George feel even older than he is.
So you were just, you had porridge down your front. So just getting ready for bed.
So it's strange because I know, and obviously I've grown up and I've watched the game, and it's strange when I talk about the sort of that season because I did live it in the sense that I was alive, but I wasn't really aware of what was going on. And so I've grown up and then learned about it afterwards and watched the games afterwards and seen it back. But that is the one where I know that there's the famous 4-3 at Liverpool, but that is the one where it just felt that it's just not going to be, it wasn't going to be that year, because that was the game where you thought if they'd won that, the position they'd been in, it would have stunted Manchester United's momentum. It would have picked Newcastle's momentum up again at a crucial time. But instead, it confirmed that change in momentum that they'd been in. So, yeah, it's strange because it's nostalgic for me, but not in the sense that I actually lived it. It's nostalgic for me in the sense that I got brought up in all of that and then have subsequently learned about it.
It's interesting, isn't it, George? Because we've a lot of the times on these archive sections that we've done, we've looked back at a high point or a good moment, something that's been a moment of joy. But this is very much the opposite of that. But it is important to reflect on these moments in the club's history because they are huge moments, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. And in some ways, this actually was the high point of Keegan's Newcastle, I would say, in that, you know, in terms of that performance. You're playing against your rivals for the league. And this wasn't Newcastle getting a spawny victory against them defending for 90 minutes. It was wave after wave wave of Newcastle attacks. And Keegan is right when he says that Newcastle battered Man U that night. They did. They absolutely did. But the scoreline tells a very different story. I'll read the team out. Cernicek, Barton, Albert, Howie, Beresford, Batty, Janella, Lee, Aspria, Beardsley, Ferdinand. And one of the questions that Shearer asked Kevin in that interview was about, he says, you know, when you watch Man City, you must see parallels in the way they play. Keegan didn't really answer this, but he was talking about, you know, those defenders being comfortable on the ball. I mean, Philippe Albert wanted the ball. He wanted to be on the ball. Steve Howie, you know, an up classy centre half. They were all comfortable with the football. And, you know, we make jokes about the current team, sort of the football being their enemy. It was the absolute opposite. They adored the ball. And the clip we've just heard is kind of OTT in the sense of that sort of sad music that goes with it. But it was such a vibrant night that night because Newcastle were the kings. They were the kings. And It was a dreadful result, but some performance, some performance.
That season got away from Newcastle, didn't it? You think Newcastle's lack of experience of being in those situations was the thing that maybe hindered them at the end of it?
Yeah, I mean, if you look back and see it like that, Man United had already won titles. Ferguson was very experienced in that sort of situation. Kevin Keegan himself was still a relatively novice manager. I mean, he'd been away for 5 years in Marbella or wherever it was playing golf before he came back to Newcastle to bring them up to save them from relegation to third tier, bring them back up to the Premier League. He was only his third or fourth season of manager. He hadn't experienced that sort of situation, and a lot of those players hadn't experienced that sort of situation in that environment that they're in, and they were trying to win the title in a different way. So it wasn't a lot of people say, oh, if he just brought in a defender, if he just done it, he didn't. That wasn't how he believed that football should be. That wasn't what he wanted to do, Kevin Keegan. That wasn't the way that he wanted to win the title. So it wasn't in his mindset to do that. And a few years ago, I remember watching one of those Sky Sports documentaries where they have four of them sitting around, and I think Ginola and Beresford are on there. And I remember vividly Ginola saying that we never even thought we need another defender here. That wasn't even in their mindset at that point to think we just need to shore up and win a few games here. That wasn't what that team was built to do. And you'll never know, but you could almost argue that if they had tried to do that, would they have been as effective anyway? Because that wasn't how the team was set up. Those players, as Alan said before, it was just go out and play, be free. And if you remove that freedom, would they have been as effective a team? There's so many what ifs, and it will remain that big what if season in Newcastle United's history. Well,
it's funny you say that, Chris, because I think that match was David Batty's debut. And I do also remember that sense of, what's Keegan doing bringing in a holding midfielder?
You know, why playing
a holding midfielder at home? And obviously, Batty was very good on the ball as well. But we had that sense of, really? This is a bit defensive, isn't it? And of course, it was anything but. I mean, I think the sadness in some ways come. I mean, it was a big moment not doing it. And obviously, there was a huge amount of tension and upset. But at the end of that season, and I know this from speaking to players at the time, but also just my memory as a fan, was that, fine, we'll do it next year. And then that was the summer that they brought in Shearer for a world record feat. You do not make a bigger statement than that. And the sad thing is that, you know, things were changing behind the scenes, as Kevin talks about in that piece, and he was probably exhausted. I think he was sort of mentally exhausted at the end of that season. But really, at the time, it was, okay, well, we didn't do it this year, but we'll do it next year.
I spoke to Rob Lee about that game a while ago, actually, and he said Newcastle could have played till midnight that night. They wouldn't have scored. Which is, you know, Peter Schmeichel would have still been saving shots gone even midnight. It's just an incredible moment, isn't it? But, you know, I mean, we apologise, dear listener. You're used to some joy and some light, but it's always good to look back on these moments and see exactly what's happened, isn't it? And what a fantastic game of football. But what a fantastic era for the club as well. And would love to see some of that again.
Oh, blimey. I mean, it's ruined my life, really. I mean, it was because I always expect, I expect football. It was, you know, 92 was the year that I came back from uni, and I went to every home game that season in the promotion season. And, you know, I was literally getting to the stadium 90 minutes before kickoff because that was the only way you could be guaranteed to get in. Yeah. And then got a half season ticket halfway through. And I will always relate football back to that season. Mm-hmm. And then the first couple of years back in the Premier League, to me, that is what football is. And to me, that's what Newcastle is. And so, you know, for young kids who are only sort of familiar with Mike Ashley's version of Newcastle, I'm sure they get sick to death of hearing old bastards like me talk about that. But that is what I think Newcastle as a city should feel like on a Saturday night. And it's how the team can be and should be. And so it's ruined football forever.
I was 10 years old when I first went to St James's Park in 1992. And at that point, I did love football. I loved playing. I loved playing it.
Unlike
I loved
now.
Playing football. And I loved, I loved the players. And I used to love watching England and all that sort of stuff. But I don't think I fell in love with football because they're very different things. I don't think I fell in love with football until Kevin Keegan came to Newcastle. Oh, yeah. And that happened with that team. And I think that was the beginning of my long relationship with Newcastle United. And that was where it started. And to me, being able to sit and talk to Alan Shearer and listen to Kevin Keegan talking about those times, I mean, it's amazing to me to do that. It's a fantastic privilege. And, you know, I mean, we're lucky that we actually got to see that, George. You know,
we're
in a situation we're in now. But never forget, I mean, there's some kids who will never know that, who might never know that Newcastle United. And we got the chance to see it. We were there.
Yeah.
We saw it firsthand. It's amazing. And, you know, hairs on the back of your neck standing up listening to that clip. Incredible stuff. Anyway, let's shelve the emotion for 5 minutes.
Let's move on
to something less emotional.
I disagree. Now is when the emotion really kicks in, because it's you and Chris facing off in the quiz.
Oh, I got an image of John Travolta and Nick Cage in my head there.
You can do that if you want.
Yeah. Let's just kill each other, Chris.
Right. This is the emotion. This is where
Have you got your dinger with you, George?
Yes.
We're going to move on to the Newcastle United pub quiz. We haven't done this for a little while, so it's nice to get back to it. And your quiz master for today's event is Mr. George Cole.
So I'm thinking, I hadn't even thought about the pub, and I should have done, but I'm just going to have to say the strawberry, I think. So I'm going to say the strawberry because we're talking about Keegan and, you know, such an iconic figure. So I'm going to pick this strawberry. It's 5-3 on a Saturday. It's just before kickoff, and we're bolting a pint before making it into the stadium. So,
which George does before games as well, yeah. Professional.
Obviously. Yes.
A couple of Jaeger bombs.
And it is this is a Kevin Keegan special, this quiz.
Okay.
So I need to find a coin. I need to toss a coin. Hang on.
He's just walked through Alan Shearer on his Zoom call.
Right. I've got a coin. Right. So we're going to to decide who goes first. So I'm going to say Taylor heads or tails.
Tails.
It is a Euro tail.
Euro. Oh, very.
So you can go first. Right. So Kevin Keegan special, round one.
Okay.
Kevin played for Newcastle between 1982 and 1984. How many league appearances did he make? Was it 78? Was it 81? Or was it 76? So how many league appearances did Kevin Keegan make for Newcastle? Was it 78, 81 or 76?
Oh, I mean, it's a guess. It's a guess, this one. Let's go with 78, first one. Come on. I'll take that. That was a pure guess.
1 point to Taylor. Christopher, in the same period, how many league goals did Keegan score for Newcastle? Was it 39? Was it 48? Or was it 46? I repeat, how many league goals did Kevin Keegan score for Newcastle? Was it 39, 48, or 46?
I was going to say, I know it's around about 1 and 2, but all of those sort of figures are around about that, so that doesn't really help. I, for some reason, have in my mind 48, but I don't know whether I've seen. I remember, do you remember when the Chronicle did all those cards years ago where you could get all the different...
Yes.
I think I remember that being on one of them, so I'm going to go for 48, but I'm probably wrong. Yes.
Oh, Christopher.
One all.
Christopher Waffles.
It's not a bad record, that. Okay, it was in what is now the Championship. 48 goals in 78 games. That's pretty flipping good. Right, we now have two penalty shootout rounds, okay? So this sounds very complicated,
but it's not, okay?
So what I'm wanting you to do is to name a team, a Newcastle 1-11 between you, or players in that team, and we're going to do it in a penalty shootout format, all right? This will become clear as I explain, right?
I hope so.
Kevin Keegan's first match in charge of Newcastle as manager was at home to Bristol City on February the 8th, 1992. The crowd doubled immediately.
Ooh.
And Newcastle won 3-0. So what I'm asking you to do is to name as many of the first 11 as possible. You get 5 guesses each, one after the other. If you're right, you score a penalty. If you're wrong, you miss. And at the end of that, 5 goes will...
I mean, Taylor has a massive advantage of having lived through this. I mean, I probably know about 3.
Yes, I mean, I was 9, Chris. I wasn't there. Do you know what I mean?
Perhaps the next penalty shootout will help you, though, Chris. Oh. So I'm going to say that Taylor's going to go first. We'll carry on in the format that we're doing. So
do I just reel off 5 or do I...
No, I want you to name one. Yes, it's one turn each. So it's Kevin Keegan's first match as Newcastle manager, February the 8th, 1992, against Bristol City, and a 3-0 win.
Okay. Was Tommy Wright, was he the goalkeeper?
Correct.
Come on.
Chris.
I know John Anderson wasn't, because John Anderson, I remember him telling me a story about how he woke up in hospital for the injury that ended his career and heard that Kevin Keegan was coming back. So I'm not going to say John Anderson. Steve Howie.
What? Oops.
Oh, dear.
So it's 1-0 to Taylor at the end of the first round of penalty kicks. Second penalty.
Okay. Let's have a think about defenders. Kevin Scott, he would have been there at the time.
Correct.
Come on. This might be a 3-0 defeat.
Straight down the middle.
Part of me is going to feel slightly disappointed if I don't get all of these right. I'm going to be honest with you.
Chris, your second guess.
Mickey Quinn.
Wah, oops.
Oh, dear.
So it's a 2-0 lead in the penalty shootout. This is already a big moment. Taylor.
I believe a very young Steve Watson would have been there. Get in.
Absolutely extraordinary. To the keeper's right, keeper doesn't even get a hand to that.
Yes.
Come on, think of a forward.
David Kelly?
Correct. David Kelly.
That's what I was going to say next.
It's 3-1. Ooh. So this is to win the penalty shootout.
Oh, my God. Oh, Liam O'Brien. He must have been playing then.
So there we go.
Well, either my two players on the bench, were they in the squad, any of the two players that I said? Or did I just go completely wrong era?
I can't remember who else you said.
Mick Quinn, did you say?
Howie. I said Quinn and Howie. I'm Quinn was definitely there because I know that Quinn and Keith.
Oh, he was there. He was there. Yeah, no, he played in the following season. Yeah, scored goal. Right, I'm going to go through the full team.
Can I go for another one to get a perfect five? Is that all right?
Go on then. Yeah, go on then.
Sure. Chris, come on, give me this at least. Gavin Peacock.
Correct.
Get in. Stitch that waffles.
Yeah. Tommy Wright, Ray Ranson. Alan Nielsen, Kevin Scott, Mark Stimpson, Steve Watson, Kevin Brock, Liam O'Brien, Gavin Peacock, Terry Wilson, who was in his last game of a loan from Nottingham Forest, and David Kelly. David Kelly scored twice and Liam O'Brien once.
David Kelly was the first Newcastle player I ever met. Outside of a game.
Is that why he left?
Shut up, Chris.
This is taking forever. Come on, we're moving on. It's 2-1 to Taylor. So the second penalty shootout. Kevin Keegan's second spell as Newcastle manager ended with a 3-0 defeat at Arsenal on August the 30th, 2008. So I want you to name me the Newcastle team from that day. And Chris, you can go first this time. It's a 3-0 defeat at Arsenal.
Shea Given.
Correct. Taylor.
Jose Enrique.
Just drop me microphone. Correct. Yes. 1-1. Chris.
Michael Owen.
Oh, I mean, Dinger's lost it. Ding.
Oh, we can do tablets for that, George. We can sort that out for you.
Correct. Chris taking a 2-1 lead in the penalty shootout.
Jonas Gutierrez.
Correct. This could not be closer. What a penalty shootout. That's a perfect penalty shootout so far. Chris.
Jesus.
No, he was not playing. I'm sorry, you're wrong. Jesus came on in the second half.
Jesus.
Fabrizio Colaccini.
Correct. Taylor.
2000.
Taylor steps up.
Oh, Shola Amiobi. Shola Amiobi.
Surely Shola. Correct.
Get in. Come on, three Chris.
Wow.
How are you, Christopher?
Attention.
In midfield.
I'm more nervous about this than I was about interviewing Alan Shearer, to be honest.
Joey Barton.
Joey Barton?
What?
Oh. He may well have been. Was he in prison then? I don't know.
I don't know. So, Taylor, it's a crucial moment.
Doing a 10 stretch.
It's a crucial moment here.
If I get this right, do I win?
No.
No.
Right. Oh, God.
I'm going to have to hurry
you. Oh, shit. Yeah, I know you are. I know. I'm sorry. Stephen Taylor.
Stephen Taylor is correct. So, Chris, you've got to score to stay in this penalty shootout. You've got to score. There's no alternative. Well, there is. There's losing.
So I've already
Chris
gone through
not,
the centre-back, so
Chris,
who's right back?
There's not many
back.
Options left, Chris. I'll be honest with you. This is difficult now.
Habib Bey.
That is a great answer, and you get a ding for that. So this is to win it, Taylor. I'm very impressed. This is to win it, to win the quiz and to win the penalty shootout.
To win the whole, already been said.
It's to win the whole thing. Well, I'll tell you. Enrique, Given, Gutierrez, Owen, Shola, Colaccini, Taylor and Habib Bey are the correct answers so far.
Oh, God. No, it was too late. Charles and Zogbia. It was too late for Charles and Zogbia, wasn't it? He was gone by then. Oh, no, because
no.
he went with...
Insomnia. So it was insomnia from...
Yeah, Charles and Zogbia.
Charles and Zogbia.
Charles
for
and
the penalty shootout. For the quiz itself.
Come on.
Correct! Yes! This week's winner.
Yes!
Wow. Wow.
Good game. That was a good performance, that Taylor. I'll give you that one. I'm not quite as bitter.
Oh, proud of myself. Well, he would have had 5 out of 5 if the first one had counted as a 5. But,
Christopher, I mean, waffles.
Extraordinary stuff.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Extraordinary stuff.
Good quiz.
It was a good quiz. It lasted too long. I apologise.
It did last too long, but I'm sure we can do something about that in post, can't we, chaps?
We can just edit it out completely.
Yeah, just edit the whole thing.
That was good.
Oh, good. Great questions, though, George. Wonderful.
Thank you. I like the penalty shootout format.
Well, listen, lads, it's been brilliant today. I've really enjoyed this, and we've had a wonderful, wonderful afternoon talking to Alan Shearer about Kevin Keegan, and I never thought I'd ever get to say that, but it's been absolutely magnificent. Thank you so much, chaps, for your time, George and Chris, and we're going to speak to you very, very soon on Pod of the Tyne. Look after yourselves. Make sure you get on the website, theathletic.com/NewcastlePod, and check out that interview with Kevin Keegan by Alan Shearer. It's a wonderful, wonderful read. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Ding.
Very good.
Oh, well done, team.
Chris, I don't think you could have played all day and you wouldn't have won.
No. I had no...
I was on fire today.
My next guess was going to be Damien Duff, so I think I would have been wrong anyway.
You would? Oh, yeah. I didn't go through the whole team.
Don't worry about it.
Who was the rest
given,
of the team?
Given Taylor, Colaccini, Enrique, Bey, Gutierrez, and Zogbia, Danny Guthrie.
Guthrie, fucking.
Nicky Butt, Michael Owen, Guthrie. And Shola.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I did have a tiebreak. What was it? Oh, yeah, a tiebreak. Okay. I would have done this, but we went on far too long. Kevin Keegan's single, Head Over Heels in Love, was released in 1979. In which position did the single peak in the UK record charts? Whoever gets closest wins.
Oh,
23rd.
23, you say you got to number 23 in the UK hit parade.
17.
Well, it was 31, so Chris would
bloody
have won.
Bloody hell.
I got a consolation prize.
Got to number 10 in Germany. Wow.
Oh, my God. Well, of course it did. I mean, he's only second to David Hasselhoff in Germany. Isn't he? But, you know. Right.
There we go.
Thanks, chaps.
The Athletic.